Lecture 11, God's Plenty, the Variety of the Canterbury Tales.
We've seen to this point only the highlights of Chaucer's work, the nature of his Canterbury Tales, the range and scope of his ballads, and the brilliance of his Troilus and Crusade. In this lecture, I would like to survey the Canterbury Tales as a whole, to give you a sense of the relationships of Sentence and Solas, of Ernest and Gama, or of Ernest and Game, that provoked no less a critic than John Dryden in the 17th century to exclaim, "Here is God's plenty." The range and richness of the Canterbury Tales can be seen even in this brief review. And my personal hope is that all of you will delve into Chaucer much as he asks his own readers to delve into the richness and the panoply of his texts. I mentioned in an earlier lecture that the Canterbury Tales survives for us in manuscripts. Many of these manuscripts are compilations of fragments, chunks of tales associated together. Later scribes and then editors and book publishers and then modern scholars have sought to give a literary arc or a dramatic unity to the Canterbury Tales. Let me review a little bit some of those problems that I had mentioned in earlier lectures. Now, you will remember that the original plan of the Canterbury Tales was for each pilgrim to tell two tales going to Canterbury and two tales coming back. With 30 tale tellers, that would lead to 120 tales, a huge project that Chaucer clearly never finished. So what, in fact, did Chaucer create? It seems clear that at some point, Chaucer probably abandoned the idea of a round-trip pilgrimage. The Canterbury Tales clearly move towards their close with the appearance of the parson's tale at the end and with the simultaneous announcement that they are approaching Canterbury itself. And so, in a sense, the idea of a one-way pilgrimage appears to take precedence over the two-way pilgrimage. When we read the Canterbury Tales, then, in sequence, we may be tempted to see the ordering of those tales as reflecting or contributing to that one-way movement towards Canterbury, towards healing, and towards redemption. The order of the tales, then, as we have it, is the order that was given to it by Chaucer's posthumous editors and scribes. Remember, there is nothing in Chaucer's own hand. There is no evidence for Chaucer's authorial control in ordering the Canterbury Tales. So what we have are a couple of early 15th century manuscripts which give a general order to the tales and arrange them in what appear to be blocks or groups. Modern scholars like this order because, as you will see shortly, it seems to give a dramatic scope to the tales. It begins with what I call the first fragment, the Knight, Miller, Reeve, and Cook. It then seems to begin again with the moral story of the Man of Law's tale of the Lady Constance, with the Wife of Bath's tale, with the tales of the Friar and the Sumner, the Clerk and the Merchant, the Squire and the Franklin, and the Physician and the Pardoner. And then, through a string of tales associated in the early manuscripts together. This group of tales, the one I'm about to mention, comes together in a fragment that seems to have also a dramatic or literary unity. And these are the tales of the shipman, the prioress, of Chaucer himself, of the monk, and the nun's priest. Scholars like the idea of reading that group as a unit because each one of those tales is a different genre. The shipman tells a domestic farce fabliau, like the Miller's or the Reeves tale. The prioress tells a story in rhyme royal stanzas of a miracle of the Virgin. Chaucer himself tells the tale of Sir Topas, a parody of minstrel-like tale rhyme romance. He's interrupted by the host, and then Chaucer tells the prose allegorical story of Melibe. The Melibe is followed by the Monk's Tale, which is a list of tragic heroes, a list so tedious and so boring that the knight must interrupt it, and we then get the Nun's Priest Tale, the famous story of the talking birds Chanticleer and Pertelote. If fragment one, let's say, is a chunk of tales about language and society, about sex, lies, and money, think of this fragment, which scholars call the seventh fragment, think of fragment seven as a story about the varieties of literature itself, every genre, every form, every prosodic device, and every stanzaic or literary or poetic expression that was available to Chaucer is deployed throughout the fragment. Following fragment seven, most editors follow the old manuscripts, and they place the tale of the second nun, which is the story of Saint Cecilia, and then a strange tale by the canon's yeoman. Here, two characters enter the Canterbury pilgrimage who are not on the general prologue portrait list. A canon who is an alchemist and his yeoman or his assistant. The yeoman tells a story of this canon, the alchemist. The canon leaves in disgust, and then the yeoman tells a new story about alchemy and desire. Following that strange interlude, there is the story of the manciple, a brief tale of a talking crow, and finally, the parson says that he will not tell a tale at all, but will give a prose sermon. And at the close of these early manuscripts, we find Chaucer's retraction, which I discussed briefly in an earlier relationship, in an earlier lecture. Now, this order creates, I think, some important dramatic relationships among the tales, and it may be seen as doing two things. First, it may be seen as giving an overarching sweep to the Canterbury pilgrimage and the Canterbury literary project, a movement of hierarchies and their disruptions, a movement towards a spiritual goal which is roughly paced out according to the geography of the road from Southwark in suburban London, where the Tabard Inn is, to Canterbury itself. But secondly, this order seems to move according to the principle of quitting, which you will remember is the principle of requiting or of one-upping, where a tale teller will tell a story in response to another tale teller. Some examples of quitting. Well, the friar tells a story about sumners, so the sumner tells a story about friars. The reeve, who is a carpenter, responds to the miller, who told a story about a carpenter. The franklin and the squire may be seen as a quitting pair. The squire tells a wild story of talking birds and magic rings and flying steeds of brass set in the court of Genghis Khan. And it seems that the squire would go on and on and on almost forever in his tale until the franklin paternalistically interrupts and tells the squire that he has himself well equipped. He has acquitted himself. But of course, in doing so, the franklin quits the squire, literally quits him, shuts him off, and requites him, and responds in kind by telling another story about magic. Here in the franklin's tale, a story about magic in Brittany and about whether magic can make love happen and what happens when you use magic in love. Two tales of magic and the supernatural quit or put together here. Chaucer, one could argue, quits himself. Or to put it another way, the host, in quitting Chaucer of Sir Topas, compels Chaucer in the Melibe to requite himself. Instead of the Sir Topas, which was a wild, parodic romp through the traditions of minstrel romance, the Melibe is a solemn, powerful, deeply moral prose allegory about the nature of prudence, patience, and the moral life. To put it another way, the tale of Sir Topas is a story of all solace and no sentence, and the Melibee may well be a story full of sentence, but of no solace. The monk, similarly, is quit or interrupted when his own story breaks down and the knight must once again come in and quit him of his tedium. Now, in all of these stories and in all of these moments, we can see how forms of response are both literary and dramatic. That is, that what we have here are tales which respond to one another, but you also have characters stepping out of their roles as tale tellers to become, in effect, tale critics. And just as the host had felt it incumbent upon himself to talk about tale criticism. In this panoply of quitting lie the range of subjects and the genres that were available to Chaucer. And I want to look in a little bit of detail now at some of the ways in which these tales work. The shipman's, miller's, and reeve's tales constitute the genre of the fabliau, a narrative form borrowed from the Old French, which concerns middle or lower class people engaging in farcical sexual relationships and episodes of mistaken identity. Fabliau very often works by having people in the dark, by having people not know who they are encountering, by slamming doors, by mistaken beds. And you can see this generic quality in the Miller's and the Reeve's tales. In the Miller's tale, the so-called misdirected kiss is a paradigm of fabliau humor. Close your eyes and pay the price for kissing. In the Reeve's tale, the mistake lies in the fact that one of the clerks decides to bed the wife of the carpenter, and another winds up bedding the daughter of the carpenter. But the mistake lies in the way in which the wife of the carpenter moves the cradle of their other little child. And in the dark, one clerk is confused and ends up sleeping with the wife instead of with the daughter, or instead of in his own proper bed with his friend. These kinds of confusions, which are confusing enough to tell, these are the stock and trade of fabliau. The tales of the friar and the sumner are also tales of comic ribaldry, but they are portraits of the excesses of churchmen and the ways in which they take advantage of people commercially and sexually. They're known as anti-fraternal satires. The sumner's tale is a particularly good example of that. I mentioned the high point of that tale in the departing or the dividing of the farthing, of the farthing or of the farting in 12. And there's this wild moment at the end of the Sumner's tale when we see a figure sitting at the hub of a wheel and the spokes of the wheel radiating out from that center. And the idea is that he farts right dead center in the wheel and the fart spreads out to the edges. And that's how you divide a fart in 12. Well, this is terribly funny, right? But it's also, I think, literarily relevant. From every sheerest end of England to Canterbury they wend. Remember the general prologue opening, which seemed to describe the pilgrims massing for their journey to Canterbury as coming, as it were, from all the rim of England, on spokes of a wheel, the roads and byways coming to the hub of the Tabard Inn in suburban London in Southwark. This brilliant play, again, illustrates to me the way in which Chaucer, even at his most obscene or most offensive or most seemingly foolish, can say something about literary control, social organization, or society. The tale of Sir Topas, which I have referred to again and again, cannot go unread. I want you to recognize that for Chaucer's tale teller in the Topas, that it takes a great poet to write poetry as bad as I will read you now. Listeth lords in good intent, and I will tell it very meant of mirth and of solace. A love a knicht was fair and gent in battle and in tournament. His name was Sir Topas. This is truly terrible verse. Not that I'm making a literary critical judgment of Chaucer's inability. What I am saying is that Chaucer is parodying. He is miming to the point of extremity. The bad quality of the verse. Sir Topas, a young knight, ambling along the way on his horse. And there's a great moment in the tale of Sir Topas when the bounce, bounce, bounce of Topas on his horse is mimed by the bounce, bounce, bounce of the silly lyric. And in fact, the Chaucerian narrator is bouncing along and he messes up the meter of his line, which mimes beautifully Topas tripping on his horse. And here it is. His spear was of fine cypress, that both aware and nothing pass, that head full sharp groond. His stead was all a dapple gray, it goeth and amble in the way, full softly and runde in londe. Lordis, lordis, mean, here is a fit, if you will any more of it, to tell it wal e funde. This kind of trip over itself, the horse going on its ambling way, and it's as if the narrator has to catch himself, and then he says, lo, listen, lords, here's a fit. Now, in medieval poetry, a fit is a section of a poem. But here's a fit. Here's a section of a poem, but here's a fit. Here is a fit between things, but there's no fit at all. And then the following section of the poem begins when the narrator says, Nu hold your mouth, per charity, both knicht and lady free, and hearkneth to me spella. Hold your mouth, lord and lady, for charity, and listen to my story. The point is, the story is so bad that the narrator has to get people to hold their mouth. Be quiet, please. I know how bad this is. I can't resist the depths, the bathos of the tale of Sir Topas. So if there are comic tales in the Canterbury Tales, there are also some noble tales. And these would fit under the idealized rubric of the tales that Chaucer would have us praise him for in his retraction. We saw in the Man of Law's tale, as I had mentioned, the Clerk's tale, the Prioress, and the Second Nun. I'd mentioned in an earlier lecture how these four tales are all told in rhyme royal. A stanzaic form that Chaucer reserves, as in Troilus and Crusade, and in some of the ballads and lyrics, for poetry at its most courtly and its most elevated. In the Canterbury Tales, rhyme royal is used to tell stories of idealized, noble, or saintly female figures. The Man of Law tells the story of Constance, who endures great hardship to become a Christian saint. The Clerk tells the tale of Griselda, who patiently endures the testing of her husband. The Prioress tells a story of the miraculous power of the Virgin Mary. And the Second Nun recounts the life of Saint Cecilia. Here, Chaucer is using a formal prosodic device to signal content. Chaucer uses rhyme royal to evoke the elevated, praiseworthy, hagiographic status of these stories. Hagiography, the genre of the life of the saint. Third, there is a clutch of stories in the Canterbury Tales that are beast fables. And perhaps the most well-known of these beast fables is the Nun's Priest tale of Chanticleer, the clear singing or brilliant singing rooster who has a wife, Pertalotta. And Chanticleer has a terrible dream. And Pertalotte and Chanticleer argue about the value of dreams and their interpretation. And after their argument, Chanticleer decides that enough of this arguing, and he, in the beautiful language of the nun's priest tale, feathers Pertelota. Chanticleer exemplifies what we might call the relationship between avian prowess and avian language. What better way to talk about human speech than to have it done in the language of the birds? Chaucer had explored bird language in the Parliament of Fowls, and Chaucer had also explored bird language briefly in the Squire's Tale, when the young princess of that tale, Canacee, is given a magic ring which enables her to understand what the Squire's Tale calls bird Latin, the language of the birds. In the nun's priest's tale, the two birds debate, and the two birds' activities are interrupted by the appearance of the fox. And the fox flatters Chanticleer into singing. And at the moment when Chanticleer closes his eyes and opens his mouth to sing, the fox grabs him in his mouth and takes him away. And it looks as if Chanticleer himself will be eaten, but not before Chanticleer asks the fox a question. And in opening his mouth to answer the question, Chanticleer flies out. What's the moral of this little bit of Chaucerian Aesopica? An Aesopic tale, a little beast fable about a proud and idealized rooster and a sly and crafty fox? Keep your eyes open and your mouth shut, because when you shut your eyes and open your mouth, the fox comes in. One could argue, indeed, that that is in many ways the moral of so many of the Canterbury tales. Indeed, in the Manciple's Tale, which is similarly a story of a talking bird who cannot keep his mouth shut, we see this idea in the Canterbury tales of literary production, of voice, always working in opposition to the urge for silence. This, it seems to me, is the heart of the fourth group of tales in the Canterbury Tales, the moral lectures. Melibee is a long prose allegory about the need for prudence in living a social and ethical life. The tale begins. There was a man named Melibee, whose name means drunk with honey. And he had a wife, Prudence, and a daughter, Sophie. And Sophie is wisdom, and Prudence is Prudence. And one day when Melibee leaves the house, some men come in and they attack Prudence and Sophie and wound them. And Melibee comes back distraught. And the entire bulk, pretty much, of the tale of Melibee consists of a long lecture by Prudence counseling Melibee in proper action and in the moral life. This idea of the Melibee is, in some sense, an idea of keeping your mouth shut, of being cautious with language, and having an idealized female figure, here Prudence, stand beautifully in contrast to the garrulous female figure of, let's say, the wife of Bath. In the Physician's Tale, a terrifying object lesson in parental obedience about a man who would rather kill his daughter than have her lose her virginity, or the Canon's Yeoman's Tale about alchemy and avarice, or the Parson's Tale, a prose sermon on the seven deadly sins. Let me pause briefly over the parson. At the end of the Canterbury Tales, the last one to tell a tale is the parson. At least, that's what the host says. The host begins by saying, "Every man save thou hath told his tale. Every man except you has told his tale. Unbuckle and show us what is in thy mala. Unbuckle and show us what's in your purse." A beautiful reminiscence. Now, of the pardoner's crass injunction to the host to unbuckle the purse, but also back to the beginning of the Canterbury Tales when the host had said, "This golf aricht, unbuckled is the mala." But the parson will not tell a tale. He does not like fiction. He does not like poetry. Instead, he will tell a prose sermon, and that's what he does. He tells a sermon on the seven deadly sins. Let me suggest to you, as some modern critics have suggested, that the parson's tale represents the ultimate quitting of the Canterbury Tales. Not just in that it ends the Canterbury Tales, but that what the parson does is, in effect, quit or requite the whole experience of fictional tale-telling. We've seen quitting operate at the local level. One pilgrim tells a story that responds to the tale of another pilgrim. Now think of the parson's tale as a tale in which a pilgrim tells a story that responds to the entirety of the Canterbury Tales. It quits it or requites it by offering not fiction, but moral sermon, not poetry, but prose. Think, too, now of your reading of the parson's tale as an injunction to the Canterbury pilgrims. At the end of the pardoner's tale, the pardoner had told a moral sermon and he invited the host to come up and confess and buy a relic. But the host angrily declines. At the end of the parson's tale, we get the retraction. Here talketh the mocker of this book his leva. What if we were to see the retraction not as Chaucer's authorial deathbed retraction, but as Chaucer, the Canterbury Pilgrim, coming up in response to the parson's quitting of the tales, to the parson's sermon, and offering up the confession of his sins? These are the bad works I wrote. These are the good works that I wrote. The Canterbury Tales ends in this way, perhaps, with a remarkable Chaucerian self-quitting. And quitting, both at the local and the global levels, becomes the way of structuring these fragments and these shards of Chaucer's literary production. But when we approach the Canterbury Tales as modern readers, we can do so, as I've tried to do so in this course of lectures, not only in this sequence, not only perhaps horizontally or linearly, but vertically. That is, we may make strategic intrusions into the Canterbury Tales. Chaucer, right before the miller tells his story, gives his audience, and I believe us, an injunction for how to read him. What is in the Canterbury Tales? Let me read this entire passage. "And therefore every gentle wish thee pray, for goddess love dameth not that I say of Evelyn Tanta, but for I mot rehearse talis alla, be they better or worse, or ellis false in some of me mater. And therefore, whoso list it not I hera, turn over the leaf and choose another tala. For he shall find in owa, great and smalla, of storial thing that toucheth gentilessa, and eke morality and holinessa, blameth not me if that ye chase amiss." The miller is a churl. Ye know well this. "So was the rave, and eke, and others mo. And harlotry, they told in both a toe. Aviseth yo, and put me out of blama, and eke men shall not mock an earnest of gama. Turn the leaf, choose another tale. Here is everything. Here is God's plenty. History, allegory, morality, ribaldry, the big and the little, the long and the short." Chaucer's injunction, I suggest, is a good injunction for us to look through and turn the leaf, to find a way of understanding Chaucer's Canterbury Tales as the conspectus, as the summa of late medieval literary making, of a poetics that need not apologize for its vernacularity, and of a authorial presence, a sense of Chaucer, the controlling figure, who rhetorically cedes authority to us and invites us to choose the stories and make a personal collection of the Canterbury Pilgrimage for our own entertainment and instruction. Thank you.